Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for Banal of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, no comparison. And right now, no Weisberg, so we're trying to get Tim Weisberg in here on the show, but it's like, here he is. Okay, good. There we go. Nice. Well, good. It worked out with my no theme. Of course, this has been All of America. Welcome back, folks. After last week's Trumpapalooza, I wanted to pivot like completely away from such a crazy topic and get into something that's sort of like, I'd say it's kind of like out of my comfort zone in a lot of ways. It's still in this realm of like the spooky, the haunted, the ghostly realm, because I've found it more and more interesting over the years. And since this is season 10 and it's sort of like a celebration of all the great friends we've had over the years, I wanted to bring on these two guys. They were on my short list when I put together the season 10 list. Talking about Chris Balzano and Tim Weisberg, they have a tremendous resume here in this field. As I said in the description, they're seasoned paranormal researchers. Tim Weisberg and Chris Balzano together, they wrote the book Haunted Objects. That's what they talked about last time on the show, and that was way back in 2012, which is crazy if you think about it. October 2012. We were still talking about the Mayan calendar back then. That's how long ago it was. And Chris Balzano also wrote Dark Woods and a bunch of other books you can tell us about, but the one that most sticks out is Dark Woods. That's the one we talked about here on the show. And they're both sort of like, and of course, Weisberg is one of the co-hosts of Spooky South Coast, the wildly popular radio program that broadcast from the South Coast here in Massachusetts. So the local guys as well, and, you know, we used to run kind of the same circles in a lot of ways. Chris moved out of state, but back in the day for a while there, we were mixing it up in the Knights of Columbus halls in Watertown or whatever the whatever the hell that thing was. You know, and sort of having some adventures, brief adventures, and so I've known them in person, and I've known them in this field for a long, long time, and, you know, I want to get them back on the show here to be part of the final season. So welcome back, Chris Balzano and Tim Weisberg. Thanks for being a part of this, guys.
Hey, thanks for having us. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you okay.
All right.
Chris, cool. You good? We got Chris?
No, usually we don't. This is what happens. We try to bring Chris into the South Coast show all the time, and this is what ends up happening.
Oh, shit. All right.
Damn Florida.
All right.
He's like in the triangle.
Let me see. It's so weird. We just get you on. And, let's see here if I can get him just to call into the show now. All right, what a mess, folks. Anyway, it's so weird because right when we were about to get on the show, we had trouble getting Tim connected, and now we lost Chris. But how have you been, Tim, since the last time we talked? It's been, like I said, 5 years, you know, since we connected.
Oh, I've been busy. I keep busy all the time. Been going on all different kind of paranormal haunts and different events, and taking a couple of cruises and all kinds of things. And started working in the TV world, which is a, you know, a scary venture unto itself, probably more scary than what you encounter in the paranormal.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. All right, do we have Chris Balzano on now?
You know, I have never been treated so unfairly and, and poorly on a radio show before.
Yes,
I don't know
have.
What kind of stuff you got going on. Wait a minute, yeah, this happens to us all the time, doesn't it?
You get treated on your own show.
Yeah, yeah. I was gonna say, it's like finally someone snapped on me on the air. I knew it would take 10 seasons. I figured after Linda Holden-Howe yelled at me, I figured it was only a matter of time. But yeah, nah, man. Sorry about that. We always seem to have weird technical difficulties when we all get together, so it's no surprise.
Yeah, and I'm actually using a landline right now. I can't remember the last time I actually held or like a real phone to my ears before. I forgot how comfortable it is.
It's really underrated, dude. People need to get nostalgic about that shit. Those hipsters need to. It's like the one thing they won't go back to is landlines. It's like, no, you're missing out. So Tim gave us the rundown on what he's been up to since we last chatted. So, what have you been up to down there in Florida? What have you been, you know, what as I said, I don't know if what you heard at the beginning in the intro and everything, but you know, last time we talked was 2012, so it's been 5 years. Almost since we all got together here.
Yeah,
on
coming
the show.
Off
so
of
what have you been up to?
Objects.
That's right.
You know, I kind of got out of things for a while. I kind of put the whole paranormal thing behind me, and was trying to work on other things. And to be honest with you, I was still a faithful listener to you, still a faithful listener to Spooky South Coast, and. They were doing such good stuff over there that I could never, like, fully let go listening to you guys because there's always something intriguing going on. And so, you know, I just recently, probably about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, I got back into working with Spooky South Coast, you know, trying to get some guests on that I thought would, intrigue and challenge the audience. And then probably about a year ago, I started really doing my own stuff again. So I'm really focusing right now on kind of more of legend tripping type of that's kind of like my focus on the paranormal now. So I'm approaching the paranormal much differently than I used to. You know, I used to be as much of an investigator as the next person and enjoying that kind of part of the paranormal world now. I'm doing a lot more legend tripping and experiencing stories and haunting. So, and I've been writing about that, and I started my own podcast about that as well. So that's all done on the next show.
I've been following the exploits of the legend tripping pursuit. That's actually sort of a good jumping off point in a sense, because I guess I want to already get kind of deep in a sense on sort of thinking about this shit. And it's like, I find it interesting because when I talk to you guys, I'm always sort of like the idea of the Bridgewater Triangle conjures itself up, you know. And it's like, to me, getting deep about it is like, I find it just interesting because, you know, we were all, you know, chasing each other around in the Hibernian Hall and goofing around and shit, and you guys were doing this even way before I was, as far as the Bridgewater Triangle stuff goes. Like, you guys were, you know, I remember when I was writing an article about the Bridgewater Triangle, it was like, I had to track you guys down. That's how I met Chris. And then through Chris, I met Tim. And it was like, there's two websites, I think. It was you and Chris Pittman. and then this thing has, fucking exploded in the last few years. And it's just remarkable to think about. Obviously, you know, you guys and the people in Massachusetts did a lot, obviously, to sort of, and of course, Lauren Coleman, who coined the name, you know, did a lot to sort of put this thing on the map. But it's still pretty remarkable that it's become so well known now. You know what I mean? It's just really, really interesting.
Yeah.
I guess, what's your,
yeah, I think,
do you
I
have
think the idea was
sort of an idea of why that happened?
I think the idea was hibernating, in between 1983 and, maybe 2003. It was all there. It was all kind of under the surface. It was all playing itself out. But people really, they were experiencing what is the Bridgewater Triangle, whether they knew what it was or not. And then through the work of, a few really good people, Chris Pittman especially, started getting the word out. And people were, as the Internet's growing and people are able to kind of keyword experiences that they had and boil it down into a few specific terms, town, this kind of activity, they started to be able to put a name and put an area to it. So it was always there. It's always been huge, I think, although maybe like it's kind of exponentially rising as well. But people were able to actually say for the first time, I experienced this thing. Oh, wait a minute, there's this big group picture called the Bridgewater Triangle. Let me get into that. And then they start spreading it. And, you know, it's like anything on the Internet. The more things that are connected, all of a sudden people are able to kind of create these definitions for themselves and, you know, and find other people, connect to other people who are experiencing the same thing. So and it's popularity rise, you know, is rising with the popularity of the paranormal. And so anything you want that is unexplained, you're going to find there in the Bridgewater Triangle. And I think people really connect to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's a matter of the fact that people have been having these experiences for years and just didn't know what to call it. So it's kind of like now that they have a basis of comparison, a basis of other people going through the same thing, it kind of creates an identity for what it is that they're going through. I mean, I do a lot of library lectures, especially around Halloween time, where, you know, I'll raise my hand and say, how many people here have heard of Spooky South Coast before? And even at the New Bedford Library, which is like the library of the city where we broadcast the show, I might get one or two hands, but I say, who here has heard of the Bridgewater Triangle? And every hand in the room goes up. And these aren't always people that are into the paranormal. Sometimes they're just people who have come there because it's a Tuesday night and they have nothing better to do than hang out in the library.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's just interesting.
I mean, even
too,
me myself,
like
I didn't know about the Bridgewater Triangle. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, I was tracking down, you know, for me it began with, excuse me, looking into, you know, the stories that were in Charles Robinson's New England Ghost Files and finding so many of them were in Rehoboth. And then all of a sudden I started posting stuff about that and people started responding to me looking for answers. And now I was like, all right. And then, I refound Chris Pittman and I realized, oh, wait a minute, that is something. I have this other case and it's in, you know, it's in Easton. And that was really interesting. And then that picture started to emerge. So the stuff was definitely there.
Yeah, yeah, it's crazy like that. It's just really, like Tim was kind of saying about those library lectures. I mean, I've been places outside of Massachusetts and it'll come up in conversation. Like, it's somehow, it's become, like, fairly nationally known in the paranormal field. You know what I mean? Where before, like you were saying, Chris, I mean, I live in Burlington. I didn't even know anything about this until, you know, 3 or 4 years after I got into the paranormal. And I was like, wait a minute, there's this thing called the Bridgewater Triangle? So it's,
right,
it's
and the
cool
other part
in a sense,
is,
but it's also weird because it's like we like had this garage band that's now selling out stadiums, and it's like, man, it's not the same, but it is the same,
like,
really.
Like paranormal hipsters now, you know? We can't like it. It's cool.
Yeah, exactly.
It's funny, though. The other part of that is that when I talk to someone who doesn't know what the Bridgewater Triangle is, I've hooked them. As soon as I start, I've hooked them because it is such an intriguing area. So, it, you know, a lot of it has to do with the activity that's there, but a lot of it also has to do with kind of the framing that people have been able to create for it. When I start talking about it to someone in Florida, they're immediately like, okay, well, tell me this and tell me this. And so, you know, so many people are hearing about it and so many people are seeing, you know, the documentaries and the TV specials that are out on it. But even just in conversations, it's a really cool idea. It's a really interesting and involved thing that, once again, everybody can get involved in, because it's like if you're into cryptids, you're going to find it there. If you're into UFOs, you're going to find it there.
Now, I guess enlighten me in a sense. How much stuff is still like going on over there? Do we know? Do we get a lot? Tim, you're, you know, in the area, so do you hear a lot of stuff still happening there, or is it kind of like, you know, for lack of a better term, like resting on its reputation in a sense?
Nope. Every single day we get new reports of things that are going on, and it seems like since the documentary came out a few years ago, it's only amped up more. I think it's because people are in some ways paying more attention to it. But also part of it is they're more willing to open up and share those experiences. So I think that these things have been going on all the time, but it's just become a matter now of where people feel comfortable sharing it and people feel comfortable coming forward and saying, I think I've had a Bridgewater Triangle experience.
And I think part of that is also they're experiencing these things. They're able to kind of go out and research on it, but there are some really good people doing work in the Bridgewater Triangle as well. you know, whether it's someone like Kristen Good or whether it's someone like John Brightman or some of the other groups that have developed, they're actually doing really good work and they're putting their stuff out there for people to see as well. So it's impossible for it to stop because, you know, if it's not something paranormal, it's something historical, which gets people intrigued, and then the paranormal comes in as well. So it does have this cycle, but it's also because of the personalities who have come out of the Bridgewater Triangle or helped to promote it and to investigate it.
Yeah, well, like I said, you guys have done tremendous work, you know. I've had a tiny role in it because I promoted the people doing the work, but it's like the folks who were in there, who actually get down there and stuff, you know, that's the folks who really sort of like put this on the map. And again, like Lauren Coleman, who sort of realized that there was something to this in a sense. So it's like it's just really it's cool in a lot of ways because it is. While I sort of lamented that it's like our garage band or whatever, it's also cool because it's like we had our own local thing that made it big, you know, and became like a big a big
yeah. And
going
you know, in a lot of ways, I'm protective about it because I'm like Bennington Triangle. You're not as good as the Bridgewater Triangle, or, you know, down in Florida, they have the Tampa Triangle.
Like
I'm like,
too.
Oh, please, Tampa Triangle. You're like the JV, man. Like, step up to the varsity.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so
yeah.
I do see it like
yeah.
that, not only the idea of what's going on, but also that idea of, like, coining a place and, like, just investigating it. And, you know, and it's – I think the more that we've looked into it, and Tim can probably speak a lot more about this being more involved over the last 10 years, you know, whereas we – you know, in those days started to really kind of push the idea of it being an actual triangle, it has really become much more, you know, like shady and gray of where the Bridgewater Triangle stops and where it starts because so many things seem to be related to what's going on there that are just outside the lines that the lines keep kind of pushing themselves out.
Hmm. Well, talk about that, Chris. You think it's sort of like more of a nebulous zone, if you
well,
will,
you know,
the triangle.
It's interesting. And, yeah, like I talked to Lauren about this when I was writing Ghosts of the Bridgewater Triangle, this idea of, well, it's not really a triangle for the things I'm seeing, you know, and I was giving my reasons. He's like, well, I meant it to be a template. I meant it to be something to kind of put out there that people would then work from. You know, and a great example of that is something like Lizzie Borden. So Lizzie Borden is in Fall River, which is outside of the triangle, right? But Fall River technically used to be part of Freetown, which is one of the apexes of the triangle. So it's really something that should be
right.
included. I'm saying, okay, so now Fall River is okay, so maybe now it bleeds out into New Bedford. And then it kind of grows from there. And also, you know, the nature of what was going on, you know, Lauren didn't really look at a lot of different, like, ghostly type things in his original writing
yeah.
on it. Okay, so now if we start including that because it does seem part of the mix, then it, all of a sudden the borders start kind of pushing out a little bit more.
Yeah, this is
you're something.
Yeah, this is what we argue about all the time. Chris likes to do that thing on his phone where he can't hear what I'm talking. He likes to be talking. This is something we fight about all the time, and that's the actual borders of the triangle. Because Lauren Coleman, when he originally coined the term, he was talking about East Bridgewater, West Bridgewater, and Bridgewater proper. And even Aaron Cadieux kind of expanded the borders beyond that. But even his, I argue with, because I feel like the Bridgewater Triangle is a living thing, and I think that it's growing, and as it's feeding on us and as we are feeding into it, it's expanding more and more. So I actually consider Fall River, New Bedford, I consider that area part of the Bridgewater Triangle. I think down into Rhode Island where you have these repeated types of paranormal activity, and Rhode Island has, just as much as they have ghosts, they also have UFO flaps, they also have Bigfoot sightings with Big Rhodey. So I think that the entire, you know, southeastern New England area is becoming the Bridgewater Triangle as these borders just seem to have to keep – it's almost like it's bulging at the seams.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah, and it does seem like that. It's it seems like weirdness is picking up. That's for sure. And if you're in an area where weirdness are – where, you know, they already traffic in weirdness, then you're more likely to get more weird shit happening. So that's not a huge surprise. And sort of piggybacking on to that is the Pukwudgies thing, Chris. That's become massive. Like,
yeah.
I sent you that picture on Twitter of, I think it's like a local beer, but still, it's like there's a beer, a Pukwudgie beer. So it's like that.
There is. There's
you know,
Pukwudgie
I don't even know
tavern,
if we could have gotten away with
Pukwudgie
it.
Pukwudgie beer, yeah. You know,
yeah.
And it's, I think the word ultimately is engaging, and that's what people like about it, and that's what people connect to. You know, over this summer, like last week, I was looking at Pukwudgie, you know, activity in Indiana, you know, and in doing that, I began to look at more of kind of the stuff in upstate New York and Canada, and realizing that, you know, the Bridgewater Triangle definitely does not have, you know, a copyright, if you will, on the Pukwudgie, but it does seem as if, you know, this idea, which is kind of always there, and it's in every single culture, these small things that kind of invade your life, sometimes they're tricksters, sometimes they're darker, they do engage us, and they do kind of permeate culture, and they kind of reflect what's going on. And so just that word Pukwudgie, when that word started getting out there, people really jumped on it because it became a really good explanation for a lot of different things that were going on. And you were able to kind of finally say, like, oh, you know, I think of, like, Robert the Doll. Like, instead of Robert did it, it's like, you know, well, Pukwudgies did it. This is a Pukwudgie. And people started changing their filter of what it was. And because it's such an engaging figure, because it's such a cool word to say, I honestly think, people just really latched onto that.
I think that has a huge,
you know.
Yeah. I never thought about it until you said that. But, yeah, it's like the word is so fucking cool that it's like the squonk that we talked about with Jason Offit a few weeks ago. It's like, it's just such a weird fucking word that you want to know more, and then you become enchanted by the mysterious creature.
Yeah, and, you know, much like the Bridgewater Triangle has that, like, automatic almost brand naming to it, Pukwudgies are the same thing. And really, in kind of, maybe we can get into this a little bit later, but like really kind of looking at some of those stories that I was getting from different parts of the country, you know, I think the word Pukwudgie is supposed to mean little people or small people, that it really is this umbrella term that covers a lot of different creatures that are out there. And so when I give a description of a Pukwudgie, so many times I hear like, okay, well, that's not exactly what I experienced. I experienced this, but I feel really comfortable calling it a Pukwudgie. And so originally I used to be like, well, no, that's kind of not what it is. It's not red hair, it's this, or it's not. And people were very adamant that what they were experiencing was a Pukwudgie. And so I kind of took a step back and I realized, you know what, I think Pukwudgie is a bigger umbrella term for a lot of different species of unexplained things that are out there. And I think that if we kind of leave it at that, that's part of the explanation of why so many people are able to connect to it and kind of go out there and use that word, is because it does mean a lot of different things to a lot of people.
Yeah.
I also think, too, though, that...
There you go, Tim. Yeah, I was going to loop you in here, yeah.
I was going to say, Pukwudgie's become one of those things where it's been bastardized, too, where the original intention and the original meaning of it has gone away because it's become a marketable term. And Chris, you know this because we did a whole episode of the show about it where we talked about, you know, J.K. Rowling taking that into her universe,
right,
that she's created. And it's become something that has kind of gone beyond the original intention. And I get people that tell me all the time that they think that they've had Pukwudgie experiences. And I'm like, but you don't live in the Bridgewater Triangle. You don't live where the Wampanoag tribe is from. So your Pukwudgie is actually something else, but it doesn't matter,
right,
because Pukwudgie it's become like Kleenex. It's become, you know, it's
right,
become the generic term for something when it's actually a proper name.
Yeah,
you know, exactly.
And one of the things.
That's a great way of putting it.
And you know, we saw that on both extremes, Tim. Right, like we've seen the Pukwudgie, which is the J.K. Rowling Pukwudgie, which is the kind, helpful, help the person to become, you know, acclimated to America, and therefore was like, you know, one of the things held up as what should be the, you know, the four pillars of our school. And then we've seen the other one where it's like this soul-sucking beast with like spikes coming out of its head and stuff like that. And both of them have kind of have their own little life now in the world. And it's not necessarily what those original Pukwudgie stories were, or like kind of what the first ones that I was getting reports about, you know, in areas like Freetown were about, and yet, like, people are very, very comfortable, like, latching on to that term.
Have you ever heard Pukwudgie stories from the UK? Because that was something I heard recently. Somebody telling me that the idea of Pukwudgies has now reached the United Kingdom. And I'm like, but they're not the same thing. You have your own name for it. Just,
right,
you know,
it's called a leprechaun.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like an elf or whatever, man. Like, they have the original shit. Why would they say that? Yeah. Well, they like
one of the things.
Stuff, so.
Oh, go ahead, Tim.
I said it's just because it's not as popular as Puckwudgie, you know? As that
yeah.
term become the new happening thing, that's what everybody wants to equate these things to. But look at how many times we've had to take things that happen here in America and try to put, you know, old world sensibilities to it, and it doesn't always fit. So I think that there's that need
right.
to have. Chris will tell you this. I like to call Chris an analytical folklorist. So he'll tell you that you have to hold on to your own legends. You know, you can't let them be bastardized. You can't let them be homogenized. You have to kind of hold on to them and keep them as pure as you can.
Yeah, one of the things people
yeah,
forget when
like,
they use folklore and they kind of mix it with what's called urban legend is the idea of folklore is folk. You have to have folk. It's your people. It should be your the stories of your people, of your region, of your, you know, background. And when you start to take – now, you know, something like a Puckwudgie in the U.K., they've got a much better history than we do of fairies, right? But I can imagine
right.
2017, if you start coming out with the fact that you think you got a fairy in your house, people are going to have a – kind of look at you the wrong way and because it's like an antiquated term and it's, you know, it's something of that you tell little children. But if now all of a sudden you can give it a new word, if you can say it's a Puckwudgie – you know, okay, well now I don't know anyone that would take anyone more seriously for using the word Puckwudgie, as I can tell you, not being taken seriously.
Yeah,
by
but
people.
It has a clean, it has like a clean slate. It comes with none of that sort of like baggage that you get with like
old world baggage.
If you tell anyone you saw a fairy, an elf, a goblin, anything like that, it all, you know, that conjures up so many images. If you tell someone who's never heard of the term, it'd be like, I ran into this little thing and da-da-da-da, and it's like, there's these, you know, they're called, and you should say, in Massachusetts, New England area, they're called Puckwudgies. I don't know what they're called here, but you know what I'm saying. So it's like, it brings with it a freshness that can kind of help you shake off the baggage of what people might have as a preconceived notion, like you're saying. If you're like, I got an elf that keeps pestering me, people are going to be like, get the fuck out of here, dude.
Right, that's an old story. What are you talking about? You know, little kids believe in fairies. Those are, you know, those leprechauns. Oh, come on, man. That's like my grandmother used to leave milk out for a leprechaun. What are you talking about?
Well,
like, I'm not about to believe that. And yet, you know, and what that does is you're taking the folk out of folklore. You
and,
know,
and
so maybe
right,
it becomes
right.
something else, but.
You're doing that thing again.
Go ahead, Tim.
You look at it as this. It's almost like the terminology that we use now is supposed to be the grown-up version of it. So, you know, like Chris was saying, you know, they think it's ridiculous to believe in leprechauns, but it's okay to believe in Puckwudgies. That's because we kind of look at it as we think that we figured out, like, oh, leprechauns must really just be Irish Puckwudgies. And so we think that we've stumbled upon some kind of
yeah.
answer. In actuality, this answer and definition that we're using is just some other kind of folklore.
Right, right. And it's also, it's uniquely American because it comes from the Native Americans. So it's, I could also see there's sort of a cultural thing there too, where it's like people, either they couldn't believe or they just couldn't get the idea across to other people where it's like elves and leprechauns, that's European, those aren't, but, you know, it's like if you tell somebody you ran into a leprechaun here and maybe in Massachusetts that might be believable, but in you know, Colorado or Texas or some shit, they'll be like, "Get out of here, dude! There's no leprechauns in Texas, dude." But it's
no,
like,
it's
no, what I, what's that? Yeah, they have chupacabras.
But it's probably
but like, no. What I mean is, it's a Puckwudgie. It's this kind of Native American thing, you know. And then I think that kind of helps with the popularity of it because it's like a uniquely. It's our, like Chris was, like Tim was saying, it's like our American leprechaun.
Tim, did you see the show on Starz, American Gods, and it's based on the Neil Gaiman novel?
No, but I heard really good things, and
a lot of my
14 friends like it.
That was the perfect allegory for what it is that we go through in analyzing the folklore and the mythologies of America, is it's the old gods versus the new gods. It's the old way of looking at things versus the new way of looking at things. And in the end, they're all right. They're all part of the collective mythology. But the part is that the show does a great example of showing how these are always at odds with one another and that there's no way to kind of just accept them across the board. And that's what we've dealt with a lot of these legends. Even the Bridgewater Triangle, people look at that and say, you know, this isn't this isn't your own thing. This is something that's happening everywhere, and they're trying to take away the idea that, you know, this area has some sort of special nature to it, and they say, well, that kind of activity happens everywhere if you pay enough attention to it. No, but not with this type of frequency, not with this type of volume. And that's the same thing. We can keep those identifying characteristics of the Bridgewater Triangle and keep it our own, and we can do the same thing with all these legends. Let's kind of just keep that identity for it, and let's just all enjoy it for what it is.
You know, it's almost as if the every generation or every, you know, every few years, people want to do a clean burn of the old stuff and kind of reinvent things and use new words and use new terminologies. You know, I see this all the time in education where people want to take out, you know, buzzwords that were popular 5 years ago and replace them with buzzwords now that explain the same exact thing. I think the same thing happens, you know, whether we're talking about, you know, our gods or whether we're talking about our mythology or our folklore that kind of builds our nation. We're talking about ideas of the paranormal. And what they don't realize is you just burned something down. Guess what? Like, it's coming back up. You're making something from the old anyway. And so those themes, those same ideas are going to keep poking themselves through because they're kind of universal. And not only that, if we believe that all this stuff is real, they're all still there. So you can call it whatever you want to call it. You can try to push it to the side and come up with something new. But, you know, whether you're going to call it, you know, a demon dog, or whether you're going to call it, you know, some kind of other cryptoname or a werewolf, there's still these weird, like, dog-type creatures in the Bridgewater Triangle. You can try to rename them, but the fact of the matter is they're there. So no matter how much you burn away, those roots are still going to show themselves because they either are something real or they point at something that we really need.
Yeah, because, like, in another generation, the next generation of researchers will come along, and they'll kind of like, they'll hopefully, the good ones, will like dig into the past, and they'll be like, wait a minute, this goes back to that thing, and they'll resurrect the things, and it is like a cycle in a lot of ways. Now, and I think also both the Pukwudgie and the Bridgewater Triangle benefit from like the internet age, from sort of like this, I think we can all agree that this, like we talked about the Bridgewater Triangle bursting at the seams, it feels like the paranormal is like, it's like how they say the universe is expanding. It's like the paranormal is like slowly but surely expanding, like in popularity and mainstream appeal. It's like, I often laugh though, because it's, you know, you got like fucking comic books and Comic-Con and like Big Bang Theory. It's like the paranormal is, even though it's got the cable shows and stuff, the paranormal is still, like, one of the last vestiges of, like, nerd culture that hasn't been stolen and adopted by the mainstream. It's kind of funny in a lot. I mean, it comes and goes, you know, X-Files and that kind of thing. But it's like, you know, comic books have affixed themselves into the zeitgeist in a way that, like, the paranormal still remains just a little bit on the fringe, where it's like, there are a lot of people that still, you know, it's a weird thing.
But Chris and I do, we've done shows on this in the past where it never really does completely exit the popular subconscious. I mean, there's, whether or not, it's just kind of, it's the idea of going out there and looking for the paranormal that ebbs and flows. But those paranormal themes are always there. There's always ghosts being used as literary devices. There's always monster stories being told. There's always horror movies being created. So this stuff is always in the back of our mind because we always fear what we don't know, and we always kind of get off on that fear to some degree. So it's really just the idea of going out and looking at this and making it socially acceptable to accept that this stuff is real, that actually ebbs and flows. The paranormal is always there brimming below the surface.
Right.
Yeah,
right. We know what it is
to be water.
What's that?
Oh, I'm sorry. The paranormal is like water, man. It finds the cracks. Right? So just
exactly.
When you think, for example, that paranormal TV has reached its point where nothing else can come out, then all of a sudden people come out with a new idea, a new twist on it, a new niche that's like someone who might not be into one of the bigger shows. They might not be, you know, into this show, but how there's a show where, like, people are investigating, like Tim's show, people are investigating a town and trying to get, like, an overview. Or, like, okay, well, no, but now this is, like, you know, maybe females. But there hasn't been a really female show I've connected to, but now they're a female. No matter what vacuum seems to be out there for TV in general, for the way people consume, the paranormal seems to find a way to fill that hole.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think Tim can appreciate this. I've always likened the paranormal in a lot of ways to pro wrestling. And that kind of speaks to, like, what Chris is saying, where it's like it's always been popular, and it kind of ebbs and flows and goes up and down in sort of mainstream popularity. But it's like there's a weird sort of hang-up with it, especially – and it's ironic, the two fields, because it's like with pro wrestling, people don't really say this anymore, but the old thing used to be like, you know, that shit's not real. You know, that's fake, that kind of thing. And both fields have that kind of weird, like, that weird sort of – liminality, that weird sort of like, what is reality, what is real, what is fake, that kind of thing, where it's like with the paranormal, it's like, you don't believe that shit, do you? You get some of that from people, you know? So they're very weird, they're very similar in a lot of ways. You know, you wouldn't think it, but they are really, really similar, like in public perception in a lot of ways.
About that, too, about that analogy is that I always call it, and I don't mean any disrespect to anybody out there who's either a paranormal fan or a wrestling fan, but it's what I call the lowest common denominator factor. You know, it's like there's always going to be the general population of the masses, the general percentage, the most average American that you can find that's going to be into these things. And I think that there's a reason why. I think it's because it tugs on something with us emotionally and psychologically, where wrestling, we can allow ourselves to get lost in the storyline knowing that this fighting isn't real. If these people were really beating the crap out of each other like this all the time, it would be brutal barbarianism and we wouldn't want to watch it. But because we know that the subtext is not real, we can accept it. And I think for a lot of Americans, they look at paranormal stuff as being the subtext is that it isn't real. And that's a comforting factor for them to get involved and get interested in it. And then when they realize, holy shit, this shit is real, and then that changes everything.
Exactly, yeah. They both sort of dance along the lines of, like, what is real and what isn't real, and, like, they put the onus on the fan, if you will, to sort of, like, defend or explain or... You know what I mean? So it's very weird like that. That's why you have people that are like closet wrestling fans, and you also have people that when you tell them you're involved in the paranormal, all of a sudden they're like, they want to tell you their UFO story, even though you've known them for like 10 years and they never mentioned it. You know,
well,
they kind of keep it close to their vest.
Our president is into wrestling now, so maybe that'll lead to more people being into the paranormal as well.
You know, what's interesting about what you guys are talking about in terms of wrestling, guess what? They're still asking about it. You know what I'm saying? Like, when they're, defiantly telling you that it's not real or that it's fake or, oh, what do you have? They're obviously, it's on their mind. They're talking to you about it. They're engaged in it. You know what I'm saying? They have an opinion on it. And, you know, oftentimes that means they're willing to talk about it. And even if they've got their arms crossed and are kind of being this, like, prove it to me idea, they want to discuss it, whether it's because they don't believe it, and they, part of them really kind of does, or whether it's just because, like, you know, it goes against some idea that's kind of in, you know, in their gut, they're still talking about it. They're still talking about wrestling. Guess what? I haven't watched wrestling in so long. When you guys were texting last night about it, I was like, wait a minute, what about Kurt Angle? Wait, what's been going on? I haven't heard it in a while. Like, you know, even though I've been, detached from it and not really interested at all of a sudden it starts to stir something up in me again, and I want to know. And so, you know, the paranormal does that exact same thing to people.
But there's a reason why, though. It's because it deals with very basic, fundamental human themes. So wrestling at its very core is good versus evil. The paranormal at its very core is science versus belief. It's life versus death. It's what we think we know versus all that we don't know. So you're getting to these very basic, fundamental questions that we have about ourselves and about our existence in the universe, just kind of put into these little brief morality plays for us.
And the fun thing is, no matter what time or what era you're in, you can just take those black and white concepts, those templates, right? Those and you just put them in different clothes, you know. So a 1970s paranormal show is hitting the same note as a 2017 one. They're just wearing different clothes in it. You know, wrestlers are their characters are a reflection of. You know, whether it's 1983 or it's 2017, they're a reflection of, like, what's going on in society. But once again, like Tim was saying, those core ideas are still the same. It's just like now I can see myself playing that good versus evil thing because now the person on screen or the person in the ghost story looks like me.
Right. We have archetypes in wrestling. We have the cool, cocky heel. We have the all-American superhero. We have the cowardly heel. You know, we have all these archetypes that people find a way to fit into, and it's the same thing with the paranormal. We always have, you know, the same archetypes as well.
Yeah. It's just – there could be – some enterprising, like, sociologists should write a thesis on that kind of thing because it seems like there's a really interesting – connection there between those two genres. But you're right about the. Yeah, I was going to say you're right about. I feel bad saying it too, but you're right about like the lowest common denominator. They both seem to get lumped in with like, you know, they're both. Neither one of them get covered in the newspaper for some weird reason, you know, unless something weird and tragic happens.
How do you think I made my living as a writer so far? Writing about both in the newspaper.
There you go. Yeah. So you're trying to change things. You're a trailblazer. Speaking of changing things, things are changing. I think, but maybe you guys can enlighten me to how they are changing, or if I'm just too out of the bubble of ghost hunting. Because I was joking with I was joking with Dana Matthews and Greg Newkirk about this on the show a few weeks ago, where it's like I don't know anybody really in the ghost field very well, except for them and you, Tim. Like I saw you guys in the Bermuda Triangle thing, and I was like. I know of Chip Coffee. I had him on the show before. He's great. But otherwise, I really don't know a lot of these folks. So it's like, I don't know who any of these guys are. So I'm completely sort of
you have to loop on that.
But.
I just want to put this out there right now while we're on the air. Because if I tell you this privately, you'll forget. But if I say it on the air, I know that the Banal of America audience will remind you. Have you ever had John Tenney on the show?
No, I have not. But I've heard a lot of good things about him. People rave about him.
John Tenney, for all that he knows about ghosts and UFOs and all things strange and unusual, and he knows about everything weird. He got his start as a researcher into the Kennedy assassination theory, and this guy is a walking encyclopedia of everything that you can know that you're not supposed to know. I mean, he would just be a perfect Banal of America guest. So now that I've gotten that out there, and the audience will get on you to make sure it happens, you can go ahead and ask your question.
Okay. Well, yeah, no, I mean, I've heard good things about him. And, yeah, between you and Dana and Greg online, I've seen a lot of, like, mentions of how cool he is. So we're going to try and do some new guests this season, even though we're doing a lot of old friends and stuff. So I'll put him on the short list for new guests. I assume I'll name drop you if I have any trouble booking him on the show.
Yeah, all you got to say.
What's that?
Just tell them Big Spoon sent you.
Big Spoon. All right.
Yes.
Well, you guys have prison nicknames? Is that what this is?
Pretty much, yeah. Pretty much.
There you go. I guess the point I was sort of meandering to in that ramble was it seems just kind of watching how it unfolds from the balcony, in a sense. It seems like, from my perspective, it seems like people were really into ghost hunting before. They still are, don't get me wrong. But now it's like, and it may be because I watch a lot of what you do, Tim, and I watch a lot of what you've been doing lately, Chris. It's like, it seems now almost like the ghost hunting takes a second backseat, in a sense, to like the location in a lot of ways. Where it's like, it's more now about going to a certain destination. And then ghost hunting when you're there. You know, it's got a reputation already. I mean, there was places like that before, and it was kind of like that, you know, Lizzie Borden House and the Waverly Sanatorium or whatever. But now even more, I think it's like people have ghost hunted a million times, and now it's like how can you change it up? You need to, like, make the location even more a part of the experience. Am I sort of, like, barking up the wrong tree, or is this kind of an evolution that's happened that you guys can see?
You are basically just getting Chris and I very excited right now, because this is the paradigm shift that we've been pushing for the last couple of years. Chris and I and Jeff Belanger, to a degree, like, we've all been pushing away from, okay, it's great to run around and have all these little blinky lights and have all these things that record data, but what are you doing with it all? What does it mean? What kind of difference is it making? It's not making any kind of a difference. You're not convincing people who don't believe that all of a sudden they should believe. The only way to do that is through experience, and we've been pushing for years now to make it get back to the experience, get back to appreciate having the opportunity to be in a place where you can reach back through time and touch history. And so this is something that, you know, makes us very excited. If you think that this is where things are going, because it's where it should be going, it's not about what you can prove. it's about having an experience about what you can get out there and feel for yourself. And that's what Chris's current project is all about, you know, getting out there and putting yourself directly into these legends and see what kind of influence and effect you have on them. And that's what we're doing as paranormal researchers. You should never subscribe to the theory that you need to be a completely objective paranormal observer, because the paranormal cannot be objective. You have to subject yourself to it to experience it. And that's where why we're seeing these changes, and people are getting away from maybe investigation shows on television, getting more into these recreation shows on television, because it's more about the experience than it is about, you know, coming back with a bunch of audio clips that a bunch of people will say, yeah, I hear that, and the rest of the people say, you're crazy, it just sounds like a bunch of noise.
Right, right. Yeah, I don't know how you do it on your things, but it would be interesting to do like a ghost hunt where it's like, no, you can't bring anything with you. Like, no technology shit, no EVPs. Just go in for the experience of the ghost hunt. Like, because I have done two ghost hunts. I'm terrible at it. I'm somehow, like, bad at ghost hunting, but I'm pretty convinced I am. But to me, it's like, I can imagine this is like a lot of people, like, I was more just, like, preoccupied with, like, is something going to happen? Is something not going to happen? I've got my little thing here, you know, I'm asking questions, I'm sort of, you know, and it's like, I'm probably going to do another ghost hunt this summer, and I think this time around I'm going to be like, I don't want anything, you know, I don't want a thing to carry around, I don't want a meter, I don't want anything that's going to, like, get between me and this fucking ghost, you know, because
right.
I think it almost does, it almost puts up a mental block in a sense.
Jeff Belanger always tells a story at our Legend Trips events where, you know, you could be walking down and looking at the device in your hand and waiting to see those lights change, and at the same time you're missing the full-bodied apparition that's standing right in front of you.
Right. Exactly, yeah.
You know, so one of the things that, you know, we're trying to do when we do Tripping on Legends is this idea that, you know, you need to go and you need to experience it. And some people say, you know, the kind of almost like the old ghost hunting rule for a lot of people was, I don't want to know anything about the property. I don't want to know anything about this. Because I want to, you know, to go in, like you were saying, Tim, I want to go, you know, and be completely objective. Tripping on Legends, and I think other people are tapping into this too, is like, no, I want to know everything. I want to know the lore. I want to get freaked out before I go there. I want to have some sense of what I'm stepping into, because that's the richness of it. And then, you know, one of the things that we have, you know, my co-host and I have to fight when we do these things is, like, there is always a seduction to have a tape recorder on and listen to see if you got evidence. There's always the seduction to look at pictures that you took afterwards and analyze them. And I think that's completely okay. But don't sacrifice the moment that you're out there for that. You know, so for example,
right.
We have been getting some – I've gotten – with this approach, I've gotten more EVPs, you know, in 6 months than I got in 6 years when I was at my kind of like paranormal investigator height. We leave the tape recorder and we go do our shit. You know what I'm saying? Like, we go do what we do. Or we have the tape recorder on and it's in our hand, but then we're experiencing what's going on. Then when we get back, we find all the stuff, and it's kind of cool, you know, but it's not the focus of what we're doing. And, you know, sometimes we get good stuff, we throw it out there. But it's so much more about the experience and what we have there. And what we found, oddly enough, it seems that if these places are haunted, the ghosts are responding to that. They seem to be more kind of likely to kind of engage you or talk to you when you're in this kind of casual way. Either that or you're just catching it, and it's not as, you know, it's almost as their guard's up when you start investigating sometimes. And so we're still doing that kind of thing. You can still go and you know, put stuff up, videotape the whole thing if you want to videotape it and look later. You know, I talked about my, I think it was 3.5 equation, which was if you go out investigating, you should spend 3.5, whatever amount of time that is, looking at your evidence. Now I feel like I should go and smack myself. I want a DeLorean, and I want to get my ass back to when I wrote that book and kick my ass, because I'm like, dude, you were just telling people to completely devote their lives to what they're doing in this. And I think, in my defense, I think that's what the paranormal field was asking for at that time. Like, you need to have that level of commitment.
Yeah, no, I mean,
and wear a black
yeah.
shirt, or no one was going to take you friggin' seriously. You know? And now, what we do,
right.
literally what we do, is on the way back from wherever we've been, boop, we'll pop in with the EVP. We'll listen to it. If we don't hear it, like, without going too deep into it, chances are we're not going to look at it again because we don't want to spend our time, you know, delving over these potential blips that might be in the stuff that we've got. We look at pictures. Do we see anything? That seems like something. Maybe we can change the lighting and see if it comes out. You know, maybe, but we're not fucking spending 3.5 times what we took to investigate to look at this stuff, because then the experience just becomes about you by yourself in an isolated place, you know, looking for a needle in a haystack, as opposed to, we were at this place and it was so rich and it has such a history connected to it. Let me tell you about that. Let me get you excited about that.
Well, first of all,
yeah,
Chris,
it's like hold on 1 second, Tim. It's like, and to what end? It's like, so you get a good EVP. It's like, we've been at this thing for, I mean, we as a field of you know, people trying to figure shit out have been at this, paranormalists, we've been at this for, like, the ghost hunting boom, let's say. We've been at this for, like, 15 years. Like, EVPs have lost their part and parcel, man. They're a dime a dozen. It's like, you know, the experience really, you know, I feel like if you're a genuine person, there's a lot of lunatics, believe me, don't get me wrong, but it's like, if you have a really amazing experience, that's better than any fucking EVP that you're going to play on the show, for me, you know what I mean? Because I've heard them all. I've heard every, you know.
How many
but,
times can you hear
go ahead, Tim.
Out? I was going to say, how many times can you hear
What's
Get
that?
Out? But Chris.
yeah, or Help Me, or Hello, or good. Yeah, Get Out is exactly, yeah, that's the one you really Chris, would, yeah. yeah.
You know, Chris was going to time travel, Chris. You would not be using a DeLorean. You'd be using a handheld pocket watch called the Omni. But, and that's a throwback for anybody that's listening. But I think part of the problem with the paranormal right now, and actually going back all the way to however far back you want to go, is the fact that we're kind of doing it wrong. Like, what Chris is talking about is the right way of doing it, just kind of going and putting yourself in an environment. Think about the way that people investigate for ghosts. And think about, now take that approach and apply it to everyday life. What would happen if you just walked up to somebody in their house, in with the place where they live, in the place where they feel comfortable, and you just walked in there on your own, uninvited, walked right up to them and said, "Hey, what's your name? Hey, how'd you die?"
Yeah, you're recording them too. You're recording. You've got you sticking a thing in their face, like, to get them on tape.
Asking permission before we record EVPs, because, you know, we have to ask people if we can record before we can do so. But I mean, that's the problem with it, is we're taking the humanity out of this, and there has to be a huge element of humanity for it to work.
Yeah, for sure. And it's like, we don't know what kind of, I mean, these, if you know, for lack of a term, like, better term, like ghosts or whatever, like, the spirit or the energy is in these places, if you're going, quote-unquote, ghost hunting, it's like they transcend the bounds of physics, man. So it's like, I have a feeling they know you're, like, you're looking for them. It's like they get the, mm-hmm. I think they probably sense that they're being sought, and it's like, that, I think that's probably kind of like you were saying, Tim. I think that's probably kind of like off-putting to the ghost, where it's, and like, think about like all the really like good ghost stories you hear. Most of them are like people that it's always like inadvertent. It's like they run into this thing, you know. It's like they bend down and tie their shoe, and they look, and there's a disembodied foot in front of them. You know what I mean? It's like it's never. It's like they say about love. It's like it's, you know, you find it when you're not looking for it. It's like kind of the same thing, I think, with ghosts. So it's like when you're thirsty for ghosts, they know, you know, and I think they
yeah.
kind of, you know, that's probably why they're like, get out. It's like hitting on a really good-looking girl at a bar or something.
It was interesting. We went to, in Arcadia, Florida, we went to this Royal Air Force memorial that's there, and there are all these graves of people who they were British, and they came over here to practice, to get flight school, because they couldn't train in England because England was being bombed, and so they all came here, and because of accidents and all this other stuff, you know, a lot of them died. So there's a whole big part of the cemetery that's dedicated to them. Now, we could have gone there we could have rolled up like a paranormal investigating team and gone there at midnight and asked them all these things and asked to talk to them, or what I absolutely hate, which is, you know, the whole confrontational thing of like, you know, get them agitated so they'll talk. We went there. We played a few songs that were popular, like in the 1940s, when these guys would have been there. like kind of like these British, almost like British, like national songs that were popular in the 1940s, like during World War II. We read a few poems that have to do with like the Royal Air Force. We went and we kind of put like a memorial on some of the graves, and then we just sat and like we're like, okay, if something happens, something happens. But if not, like we've paid tribute to the history of what this was, and now. Which I know Tim loves this idea of the using that for the history. Now let's tell the story about all these British people who are training in Florida that no one knows this. Like no one really
right.
knows exactly how much this country was like the aeronautical center of the world because everyone else in Europe was their bomb planes were being bombed, they were being destroyed, and all these people came to the United States. That's like a hidden history. Now we can use the
I never knew that till you told me
story.
About it tonight. So that's. Yeah, that's actually
yeah,
pretty
we
awesome.
Use this story
I,
of,
and
of,
it makes
of
perfect sense. I just never
happened.
Even thought about it. Yeah.
Exactly. So, and that becomes our hook into the history, and then now all of a sudden, you take a step back again, and you're like, you know what? As we're doing more and more research, we started discovering how much this school being here was part of that area's history that area has lost. And so now you start to see
yeah.
how just this one little ghost story of these lights in the sky that people think is a battle tells a really big story about our history, about that town's history, and, of course, like about, you know, the actual how we tell stories in the first place. And so it goes beyond just getting a voice telling you to, you know, telling you no or telling you to get out. Those are cool. Don't get me wrong. When you leave a place and you listen to that and all of a sudden you hear someone talking to you, I was just, you know, kind of going over some of the voices so we got in a cemetery, and I'm like, I think those are two. I think this serial killer is a pair. I'm hearing two people talking to each other, two men arguing to each other about whether or not they should kill this person. That's cool. That's great. But it's also about this history stuff. It's also about what these stories tell about us because we have found no more insight into what happens to us when we die, but we can find a lot about what we are supposed to be doing now as the living.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, I've railed on ghost hunters on the show in the past where it's just like, I wish it's actually in an ironic way. It has happened in a sense, but it's like, I wish people put as much time into Bigfoot as they do good. Now they do, which is funny in a sense. But it's like in both cases we can't seem to seal the deal here. You know, it's like
right.
these phenomena remain elusive no matter how much staggering manpower you put into it. You know, but that's another kettle of fish in a sense because it's like I mean if we segue into sort of like just ghost hunting and Bigfoot groups and paranormal groups in general, it kind of That idea of like the lowest common denominator does kind of rear its head in a way where it's just kind of like we don't have scientists looking for this shit. We have sort of like weekend warriors, and God bless them. And we need, you know, it's good that people are doing it, but it's like we need different ways of thinking of this shit because clearly we've been doing this for a long time. We haven't been able to figure it out when it comes to Bigfoot, ghosts, UFOs, anything. So you know, somebody help us.
One of the things that we post, my first TV show that I worked on was a show called Ghost Stalkers with the aforementioned John Tenney, and it only lasted 6 episodes because I think we were trying to do some heady concepts then, you know, in 2014 where it wasn't quite something that people were ready for yet. We were trying to put together, and it's something that like Chris and I had been talking about behind the scenes for years, and that's actually starting to look at the forest for the trees. So let's stop going to places and trying to worry about if we can prove if they're haunted or not. Let's just go into them accepting the fact that enough people accept that they're haunted. Now what does it all mean? How do you put it all together? What do those pieces add up to? And with this new show that I'm working on, Haunted Towns, that debuts August 5th, plug, Destination America, with this coming out, we're finally getting up that because they're going to towns and going to multiple locations that have hauntings and saying, okay, what does it all mean? So what if there's ghosts there? We want to figure out the reason why and why it's become an identity for this particular area. So that's something that I think as researchers, people need to start working on. The problem is everybody's so individualized. It's become such a niche hobby for people that they can't really work together well. And they'll create all of these unions and organizations and families and all this and that, but in the end, they're all just basic. They're copying each other's investigative styles, which is just going to keep giving you the same results over and over again. You need to have a bunch of free thinkers who are willing to go outside the box and try different things, then taking the bulk of their work and putting it all together and trying to figure out, okay, what does all of this mean now? Because that's the only way we're really going to figure out how we can make this happen in a way that is scientifically acceptable. And I can't believe I just said that because I know it's not going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. It's like they'll never – yeah, that's like the deal with the devil, the scientific acceptance, because I think it goes with everything in a sense. Like some folks will survive. Some folks, you know, a Stan Friedman, a Lauren Coleman, they'll manage to survive the transition. But, like, if once science accepts this shit, like, it's going to wipe out a lot of the paranormal in a sense. It's going to be like we'll be shoved out by the scientists and shit.
Well, I think,
UFO
– you know, Stan Friedman, guys like that, they don't have anything to worry about, because if UFOs are proven and they're proven to be physical matter, there's going to still be a need for, you know, hard science and for people to bridge that gap. What bothers me about it is the idea that people are out there thinking that they can scientifically prove the existence of ghosts. And I've said for years that ghosts aren't physical. That's why you can't prove them through physics. They're not scientifically provable. They're emotion. And you can't, you know, you can't hold a piece of a ghost in your hand or scientifically recreate a ghost the same way you can't do that with an emotion like love or sadness. You can only feel them and experience them, and that's what it is with ghosts.
Right, and that's
exactly,
where it falls short,
exactly.
because the scientific part of it can just collect the information. You know, like, if you can now understand lightning, if you can observe lightning, you've tested different theories of it, you've proven where it comes from. Okay, after that, there's no question of, well, why does the lightning have to happen? Like, do we need lightning in our lives to be spiritually fulfilled? Like, science will never answer those questions. And so anyone who spends too much time in the scientific field, you're trying to answer a question about what these things have to do, if they really exist, what do they mean for us, and all you're trying to do is try to, like, use science to capture the smoke that they leave behind. And so it will always be a frustrating thing, and I don't think those two sides will ever really get along.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. It's confounding. I mean, the whole thing is confounding. I feel like a lot of this stuff is related in a sense where it's like, you know, we've talked a lot on this show where it sort of comes in, and you've touched on it just now, Chris, where it's like beauty is in the eye of the beholder type idea, where it's like the paranormal is conducive upon the witness. So it's like,
right,
some, you may see a Bigfoot, I might see a UFO, and Tim might see a ghost. It's like, but we might actually all be looking at the same thing, you know? We may all be experiencing something that we just can't quite, like, that shows itself to us in a different way. I sometimes think that, but, you know, who knows?
Yeah, you know, there wasn't
it's
a really
confounding.
Good, when I first started doing this, there wasn't a really good field guide to how to go out there and look for ghosts, right? So even if you were, if you're going back and you're reading some of the really interesting, like, Hans Holzer's work or stuff like that, like, you could read it and you can kind of say, like, oh, well, he did this kind of thing, but there was no field guide. You know what I used for a field guide? I used a monster hunting book that was kind of like, you know, took the I think it was called Monsters by Jeremiah Greer. I could be wrong about that. But it was this idea of, like, if we're going to look for a werewolf, let's think of how a cryptozoologist would look for an animal and apply that to looking for monsters.
Right.
And, of course, there was folklore and stuff like that. But half the book was, first time I ever went to the Freetown State Forest, I highlighted the fuck out of that thing and had it all, and then brought it with me and had things pages turned and did, and basically I was looking for ghosts the way you look at for monsters. Why? Because
yeah,
so many of those core ideas are the same, no matter which thing you're doing. And like you said, guess what? Like, a Pukwudgie is a great example of something, depending on who you're talking to. It's a god type creature. It's a cryptid. It's a ghost. It's a monster. We have no idea what it actually is. And so, you know, whatever group kind of like likes their idea, whatever one they can reflect in that animal or whatever it is, they're going to take. And I think that, you know, I'm not for, like, everyone needs to hold hands and, like, but I think if you take some place like the Bridgewater Triangle, you know, if you take some place like the towns that Tim's going to be looking at, if we have those kinds of places and we have different kinds of people looking into it, I don't think we're going to necessarily get a nice, clear picture, but we're going to have a lot of really cool puzzle pieces to play with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, maybe Tim can answer this, or you, Chris, but I know Tim's sort of like mixed up in the scene up here in Massachusetts, so I think he knows a lot of this ghost hunting sort of milieu. Have the number of groups and shit dropped, or is it still as sort of like territorial as ever? Because like I remember back in the day there had to have been like 6 to 8 ghost groups just in Massachusetts, and I mean I'm sure there probably are now. It might be sort of just a different flavor of like these are the people that stuck it out. But like, have you seen sort of any change in the way, you know, paranormal ghost groups are like constituted nowadays as compared to like, you know, 5-10 years ago?
First of all, I'd say that the number of groups is still ever increasing. There's more and more people who are involved in it. It really has been the case. I mean, I wouldn't have thought that. I would have thought eventually people would have given up the ghost, so to speak, and they would have said, you know, I think that there's something better I can do on the weekends than spend all this money to go run around in the dark. But effectively, it's only just increased over the years. The difference is, I think now there's a lot less of the there's a lot less of the rigid structure that some of the groups had, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. 5 or 10 years ago, it wasn't uncommon for there to be a group that had one dominating personality as the group founder, the group leader, and everybody had to play their roles, and you were this and you were that. One was a tech specialist, one was a historian, one was an occultist, one was an angelologist, one was a demonologist, one dealt with aliens, one dealt with Bigfoot. You know, everybody had to have a certain position within this power structure. But not only specialization, but also, you know, there was a seniority kind of with it, and there was, you know, it's kind of like an oligarchy in a way. But we've gone away from that now, and I find a lot more groups are more relaxed. I find a lot more groups are like, hey, let's just get together, and a lot more groups are centering themselves around specific historic haunted locations instead of just, you know, they're having like a home base type place that they care about and that they want to protect. And I think that that's a good positive trend, because without those dominating personalities leading groups, we're also getting a lot less of the infighting. And I know that there's paranormal drama all over the place, all over the country, but for some reason New England has always been somewhat exempt from all of that. And I think it's because we're so much surrounded by ghosts and so much surrounded by this history that we can't get territorial about it. We can't piss on each other, because in the end we all have to work with each other one way or another. So that's kind of kept us from getting mixed up in a lot of that play. It still does happen, but I think that there's a big combination, too, of people wanting to work together because it's, you know, let's face it, it's more cost-effective to be able to share equipment and split the cost of renting out places and things like that. But I think the other reason is there has been a great camaraderie that has formed through social media and the exploration of this. Now, the problem isn't amongst the groups. The problem is amongst those who are trying to have the experiences versus those who are trying to come up with what they consider to be serious data and serious research. The fights happen when somebody posts up a picture of an orb and someone who's been doing this for a long time or has a background in photography tries to explain to them, no, it's not your dead uncle. It's actually just moisture that's in front of the camera. And when that starts to happen, when you start to criticize people's evidence, that's when the fights and the problems break out. And I can't figure out for the life of me how to get over that hump, because we've been fighting it now for a couple of years.
Yeah, I can see that in the stand.
Come play with us. Come play with us, Daddy.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Forever and ever and ever.